Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks of course also to the people which allowed me to speak here. So this is much more elementary story than what we had before, but nevertheless I'm quite happy with the results we got now, because in a sense this problem really was all the time there in the whole time I was in contact with non-commutative geometry, and this is really literally, because before that I was a PhD student doing quantum groups, and then my advisor sent me to a school in Oberwolfach in 2002, because he said, okay, one should work on that connection to quantum groups, and then on the first evening all the PhD students were gathered together in the lecture hall and should say two sentences about their project, and when I said quantum groups, Alan Korn immediately shot me down and said, okay, very nice subject, but unfortunately it's not related to non-commutative geometry. And that was a bit disappointing. And of course, I also did not understand his explanation at that time. But it had to do, I think, with the behavior of Hochschild homology in quantum groups. And so now I'm working on that for 4 years, mainly in collaboration with Tom Hatfield. And we start now seeing something. And recently, I also started working on some Poisson geometry background together with Nicola Ciccoli, but that's not finished yet, so this will probably only come at the very end. Yes, okay, so also elementary definitions, but probably I don't feel sorry about them. Quantum groups, you can introduce them in many flavors, many setups, but here, the simplest example in the simple setup is sufficient. We take some number Q, complex number, not zero, not a root of unity, and we define an algebra, CQSL2, in terms of generators, ABCD, and relations, these there. And if you plug in these relations, Q equal 1, then you see, okay, almost anything reduces to the fact that this is a commutative algebra, and the only non-trivial relation which remains says that this is the coordinate ring of SL2C, treated as an affine algebraic group. And, okay, I think you simply can believe me, but one can do similar things for arbitrary semi-simple Lie groups, and that's the object of the talk, this CQG. And if you look at these relations, I mean, it seems that one quite arbitrarily plugged in Qs and Q minus Q inverses where there were zeros and ones earlier, but this is not the case. Somehow this choice of generators and relations is almost uniquely fixed if one wants to have not only the algebra structure of this classical coordinate ring of SL2C deformed, but as well the Hopf algebra structure, which for Q equal 1 in the commutative case just comes from the group structure. So if you have these relations, then you can do that, and even more, in a sense, you can keep the group structure as it stands. Yeah, so the precise statement would be that as a co-algebra, the CQG is isomorphic to the classical C of G. And in a sense, this means that we quantized the space SL2C, or more generally the space G, without touching its group structure at all. And that's why at least some people call these things the coordinate rings of quantum groups.
What goes wrong if we have a root of unity?
So if you have a root of unity, then...
Still the definition.
Yeah, the definition, yeah. This definition makes sense as it stands, yeah. But you get something simply becomes zero. And this statement that CQG is C of G as a co-algebra, what does it mean? I mean, these G are reductive groups. You have Peter-Weyl decomposition. So this claim simply says that if you start with this algebra, then you will find a vector space basis, which provides you a Peter-Weyl theorem for these CQGs. So that's Voronovich theorem about Peter-Weyl for compact quantum groups. And if you now take your root of unity, then all this goes wrong. Yeah? Uh-huh. Good. So these are the objects. And the theory, as I said, will be Hochschild homology and cohomology. So plain definition, what you need is an algebra, meaning here always unital, associative algebra, and also for simplicity, always ground field will be complex numbers. And you take a bimodule, capital N here, over that algebra, and this means a left module and a right module, and the two actions commute. And then you get the Hochschild homology and cohomology groups of that algebra with coefficients in that bimodule, and you can define them as derived functors in the category of bimodules, which is the same as saying in the category of AE modules, where AE is this enveloping algebra of A, the tensor product of A, with its opposite algebra AR. Okay, so these are these Hochschild homology and cohomology groups, and as any nice homology and cohomology theory, you can write it down as torsion X, but also the other way around can be done. I mean, torsion X were invented in a sense after Hochschild introduced his theory. I mean, all that was done in 1945, and in fact, one can go the opposite way around. One can express also the tor and the X over A with arbitrary modules as Hochschild homology and cohomology groups, you know, at least when we are all over field. And this means that this Hochschild theory is really, in a sense, very fundamental, you know, because all the other homology and cohomology theories, like group homology, Lie algebra cohomology, and so on, can be written, if you want to, as Hochschild homology and cohomology. Yeah? So understanding this is quite helpful. And in particular, if you do this for group cohomology and Lie algebra cohomology, in fact, you plug in Hopf algebras. Yeah? So studying Hochschild homology of Hopf algebras is of general interest. Okay. However, of course, if we want to do non-commutative geometry, then the first question when we define some algebraic invariance is what happens if we plug in commutative algebras? What is then the geometric interpretation of that stuff? And in the case of Hochschild homology, this was answered completely in a paper by Hochschild, Kostan, and Rosenberg in 62. So they worked in the purely algebraic setting of coordinate rings of affine varieties over perfect fields. And the answer is the following. If you compute just the Hochschild homology of these coordinate rings, meaning Hochschild homology of A with coefficients in A, then you can identify these groups with the Kähler differentials as long as the variety is non-singular, you know, has no self-intersections or cusps or so. That is, Hochschild homology of a commutative algebra, roughly speaking, gives you the differential forms on the space you are studying. And Alan Kohn also gave some smooth version of that for C-infinity functions. I mean, then things become slightly more technical. You have to complete tensor products in definitions and so on. But the philosophy is Hochschild homology computes differential forms of your space. And in particular, you can read off the dimension of your space from the Hochschild homology groups, because the dimension is the biggest number where you have some differential forms. And this is exactly the point where some people, at least, were unhappy with quantum groups. Because in 1990, Masuda, Nakagami, and Watanabe computed these Hochschild homology groups for our SLQ2. And in fact, 1 year later, Feng and Sigan wrote a substantial paper which answered this question for arbitrary groups. And the answer is the following. If you plug in CQG, these quantized coordinate rings of classical groups, then all these Hochschild homology groups are in fact zero above the rank of the group. Not above the dimension of the group, but above the rank, which is the dimension of the maximal torus, that is, in case of SL2C, simply 1. And, the picture which was developed in Feng Zigan was in fact quite a nice one in terms of Poisson geometry, which I will come to hopefully at the end. But nevertheless, I mean, if one came from quantum group theory, these groups look very similar to the classical spaces, and some people simply try to mimic classical differential geometry of the group based on these things, and then this result was a bit disappointing, you know, because you had this dimension drop. These quantum groups seem to be a bit too small to deform the full differential geometry of the classical group using methods from non-commutative geometry. And I think that was the comment Alain made when I said I'm doing quantum groups.
CQG, you mean standard quantization deformation of a semi-simple group, right?
I mean, yes. G is a reductive algebraic group over the complex numbers, and I take the Drenfeld quantized universal enveloping algebra but over complex numbers, and I take the matrix coefficients of the type 1 representations. Yeah. Okay, so that was Hochschild, Kostan, and Rosenberg. And the main message of this talk is you can get, if you want to, can get rid of this dimension drop if you do Hochschild homology not with coefficients in the algebra itself, but with coefficients in a slightly deformed version of the algebra. And in the next minutes, I'm going to speak a bit about the general form of these coefficients. So already yesterday, I think in our last talk, the notion of invertible bimodule appeared. So in general, if we have an algebra, invertible bimodule just means that there is another bimodule, so that if you tensor the two bimodules together over A, from one or the other side, then you get as a bimodule just A itself. You know? So the tensor product over A gives the category of bimodules something like a ring structure, and you take the invertible elements with respect to that product. And then you can form a Picard group. Simply you take the isomorphism classes of these invertible bimodules, and the coefficients we are interested in will arise in this way. But in fact, they will be very special forms of invertible bimodules of the form of the lower part of that slide. So whenever you take an automorphism of the algebra sigma, then you can define such an invertible bimodule. You simply take the algebra itself as a vector space, but give it a slightly twisted, deformed bimodule structure by putting in on one side this automorphism in defining the bimodule structure. So in this way, to any automorphism, you get attached a class in this Picard group of the algebra. And it's an immediate computation to see that indeed this map is somehow compatible with the group structure of the Picard group, in the sense that composition of automorphisms will go to tensor product of bimodules over A, which defines the group structure of that Picard group.
But P doesn't have to be abelian.
No, precisely. You're anticipating the next slide. So there's a nice paper by Enrique Burstein and Stefan Waldmann on that topic of Picard groups. I don't know how original these results are, but at least it's a nice paper which describes the situation more or less completely. If you analyze what this map does, then you find the following. You get an injection of the outer automorphisms of your algebra in this Picard group. So this means simply that the isomorphism class of this A sigma depends on the automorphism only up to inner automorphisms. And second, that's all. I mean, if I take this, then really things become injective. You know, I get an injection of the outer automorphisms in the Picard group. Second, this is a normal subgroup, so I get a short exact sequence of groups. And in the commutative case, one can say something about the quotient. I mean, here in the first line, in the general, this pick geo is just a definition. Yeah? I mean, I say I have a normal subgroup out of A inside of this Picard group, so I can form the quotient group. And I call this the geometric Picard group. But in the commutative case, I mean, in particular for coordinate rings, but this holds for all commutative algebras, this exact sequence splits. So this Picard group of all invertible bimodules is a semi-direct product of the outer automorphisms with this geometric Picard group. And this geometric Picard group can then be identified with the symmetric invertible bimodules. That is, those bimodules where left and right action is simply the same. And this is, in algebraic geometry, simply the Picard group you get from algebraic line bundles over your space you are considering. You know? So the claim is somehow, if you ask what is the Picard group of a coordinate ring, then the answer is, take the algebraic line bundles, the modules of sections, and then you can twist on one side by an automorphism, and that's all. But in the non-commutative situation, one does not really know what is a good candidate of the symmetric bimodules, because this sequence is not split. Okay. So these are the things, and now, as I said, there was motivation to study Hochschild homology of quantum groups with coefficients in such twisted bimodules. And this came from the theory of covariant differential calculi in the sense of Voronovich. So Kustermans, Murphy, and Tousset worked on that and found out that if one wants to take the correspondence made by Kohn between cyclic co-cycles and differential calculi, and wants to somehow get this connected to the theory of covariant differential calculi, where you have usually not such differentially graded closed traces, then you have to slightly deform your theory. And if you then go from the cyclic theory to the Hochschild level, then you exactly end up with such Hochschild homology of the algebra with coefficients in such an A sigma. Yeah. So that was the motivation at that point. And what we tried is simply to compute this. I mean, me is Tom Hatfield and me, just to recall it again. What we tried to compute is this thing for our SLQ2. And so we looked up the papers, how to do it, and there was this paper by Feng Zegan, which I mentioned already, which somehow started with a very interesting remark, namely, if your algebra is a Hopf algebra, then you can realize your Hochschild homology not only as a derived functor in the AE modules, as in general, but also in the A modules itself. And even simpler, the modules you have to consider are easier. Somehow, in one side, you simply get the trivial module, the ground field on which your Hopf algebra acts by the augmentation given by this co-unit of the Hopf algebra structure. Yeah? So what you take to get it precisely, you want to compute Hochschild homology of a Hopf algebra with coefficients in N, then you do this tor of a certain right module, comma the ground field, where this right module is the coefficients themselves as vector space, but with this strange right action here. Yeah? And so those which are not experts in Hopf algebras simply relax for 5 seconds, but those which know a bit of Hopf algebras, I mean, the interesting thing is this is something like a purely non-commutative phenomenon. Yeah? If your Hopf algebra is commutative, yeah, then you can move this guy over here, and your bimodule is symmetric, and then by the Hopf algebra axioms, this cancels out, and this action simply becomes trivial. So as a corollary, we see that if we do Hochschild homology of affine algebraic groups, yeah, with symmetric bimodules, I should say, yeah, sorry, I mean, that must be, of course, symmetric then this is completely determined by these torus of the ground field with itself. Yeah? So this was the remark made in Feng Zegan, but nevertheless, somehow, what Feng Zegan then did, they went somehow a different route than what we did, because they then put Poisson geometry in, did some spectral sequences, which I will mention at the end of the talk. But we said, okay, if we have this description, what does it mean? We can now start and look for resolutions of the ground field as A modules and try to compute things by bare hand. And that worked out pretty happily. So what we found is that if you do this for this CQSL2 coordinate ring, this quantized coordinate of SL2, then you find pretty much as in the classical situation a free resolution of this ground field by left A modules, a free resolution which resembles completely the classical case in the sense that it has the structure of the classical tangent or cotangent bundle, which is free over an algebraic group. You know? So these dimensions 1, 3, 3, 1, which you see, these are precisely dimensions of 0 forms, 1 forms, 2 forms, 3 forms, and that's it. You know? And indeed, this resolution is built as some sort of non-commutative causal complex. And using this resolution, we then computed by bare hand these homologies, and the result is, in a sense, quite nasty if you look at everything. But there's one part which is quite clear, and this is the following. Indeed, there are certain automorphisms for which you can remedy this dimension drop if you want to. So you get non-zero Hochschild homology groups in degree the classical dimension of SL2C, which is 3. And okay, that was somehow nice, but what was even nicer is that these automorphisms are somehow not arbitrary. And in particular, I mean, you see there is, in a sense, a family of automorphisms for which this happens, labeled by the non-negative integers, and these are really all automorphisms for which this happens, that H3 of AA sigma is non-zero. And the simplest member of this family was quite a known automorphism. It's Voronovich modular automorphism of this quantum group, which I will speak about at the end. So the result was, okay, one can somehow see the classical dimension of quantum of the classical groups in the quantum setting in Hochschild homology with these twisted coefficients. And one must admit, it looked as if there is some reason. You know, I mean, this modular automorphism said, okay, that's not a complete coincidence by chance. Yeah, there must be something behind that. And that's what we tried to find out then, and I think now we understand it. And all this is related to a theorem by van den Berg, which goes like that. So the theorem has many, many assumptions. So up to here, that's all assumptions, and that's the statement of the theory. And it goes like that. So you have an algebra A, and you consider, I mean, you have to make a small smoothness assumption first. You have to assume that this algebra A has a finite resolution by finitely generated projective AE modules. So if your algebra A is Noetherian, say, if AE is Noetherian, that means essentially that A must have finite projective dimension as an AE module. Now, in fact, this assumption was forgotten by van den Berg in the first version of the paper, which led to an erratum later. But it is crucial, as I will say on the next slide, where I sketch the proof a bit. So that's the first assumption. But then somehow the crucial one is the following. You consider the Hochschild cohomology groups of that algebra A with coefficients in AE. And these should all vanish except in one degree. Okay, so before we go on, two remarks about that. First, what is the AE module structure of AE here? If you do non-commutative geometry, you will find in the axiomatics of spectral triples also statements about Hochschild homology and cohomology of A with coefficients in AE. But there, the bimodule structure is a different one. You know, in spectral triples, the bimodule structure is simply action on the first copy of A. Here I really mean take AE as a ring, and then I can multiply in that ring from the left, and this gives AE an AE module structure. Yeah? So I would call this the obvious AE module structure of AE, but in non-commutative geometry literature, it's exactly not the one which they somehow sometimes call the obvious one. Okay, that's the first remark. Second remark, because of this definition, AE is here not only an AE module, but an AE bimodule. Yeah? I mean, of course, I can multiply in AE from the left and from the right by elements of AE, and these two things commute. And this means that these Hochschild cohomology groups of A with coefficients in AE, which are for arbitrary coefficient bimodules just abelian groups or vector spaces, are still AE modules. So they are bimodules. And the last requirement for the theorem to work is that this one non-zero bimodule, which I will call omega, is invertible as a bimodule. And provided all this package happens to work, then van den Berg proved that for arbitrary coefficient bimodules n, one has an isomorphism of vector spaces of Hochschild cohomology of A with coefficients in n in degree n, and Hochschild homology in degree d minus n, with almost the same coefficients, but twisted, deformed on one side by this invertible bimodule omega. That's his theorem.
Do you ever get the self-injectivity for AE?
No, self-injectivity. No. I mean, one should explain something about that theorem. I mean, first remark. Okay, this is some kind of Poincaré duality in Hochschild homology and cohomology. Now, homology in degree n is cohomology in degree d minus n. And in particular, for example, if you would take as the algebra a group algebra, then Hochschild homology becomes group homology and cohomology, and then this is something like homology and cohomology of classifying space, and then this reduces to Poincaré duality of the classifying space. So in particular, as pointed out to me by Andreas Thom last week, 2 weeks ago, sorry. If you have a fundamental group of a compact acyclic manifold, meaning one which has no higher homotopy groups, then that manifold is a classifying space for the group, and therefore it satisfies Poincaré duality, and this would be a topological class of examples, I would say, from group theory. But okay, this question about self-injectivity and Gorenstein, if you are from algebraic geometry, then Poincaré duality is related to something like Gorenstein property, and somehow in the first version of the paper, Vandenberg had this in mind, I think, because in the title the word Gorenstein appears. But as I said, the requirements for the theorem to work are a bit stronger. And that becomes apparent if one looks on the proof a bit. I mean, I will not give the details. I gave a small seminar on Friday where I went through the proof in detail and I typed this up. So if somebody is really interested, I'm happy to provide this typed out. The point is the following. So there's an old paper by Ischebeck back in 69 in Journal of Algebra saying the following. If you have any ring and you have a module M over that ring and you have such a finite resolution by finitely generated projective modules of that ring, that means essentially it must be finitely presented, then for any other module N, you have a convergent spectral sequence as written there. So that's the general result. And now we look at the case where these XMR groups are all zero except in 1 degree. And then this just means, okay, this spectral sequence, the second page of which is this left-hand side, will stabilize at this page. Yeah? Because in this case, there's only one non-zero row or column. And then we get a plane isomorphism of both sides, and that's this thing here, yeah, where omega is this one non-vanishing X group. Yeah? So that's where this result of Vandenberg somehow comes from. Yeah? So the only thing which Vandenberg added is that if you now take for the ring R this enveloping algebra AE and for the module M the algebra A itself, then you can deduce this Poincaré duality in Hochschild homology and cohomology from that. I mean, that's not, this is a bit misleading. I mean, it's not that you simply plug that in and you have it. Yeah? You still have to see that in this case, assuming that this omega is invertible, you can get it over here to really get Hochschild homology. Yeah? So there is an additional step to Vandenberg's theorem from here. And indeed, I mean, this question about self-injectivity in Gorenstein is related to that. Because if you drop this assumption that M has finite projective dimension, I mean, you can take arbitrary R, M, N, and you still will have the spectral sequence. The only question is, does it converge? And to what does it converge? And if you then require the ring to be Gorenstein, which means R has injective dimension as R module, yeah, then this is precisely what you need for the spectral sequence on the left-hand side to converge. Yeah, because then these XMR groups will be zero for big degrees, and then the thing somehow becomes stable after some pages of your spectral sequence. But it still doesn't mean that both sides, I mean, this right-hand side is also obtained by a spectral sequence, and it does not mean that these two spectral sequences converge to the same thing. So even for Gorenstein rings, it might happen that the theorem is wrong. Yeah? And this becomes clear if one looks at the statement, because, I mean, back in the old days of Cartan-Eilenberg, they introduced the notion of the dimension of an algebra, which is precisely this projective dimension of A S A E module. Yeah? So a priori nothing to do with Kroll dimension or so. And this dimension of A is always greater or equal to the global dimension of A. You know? But it has some advantages in comparison to the global dimension, because the global dimension is, for example, just dependent on the ring structure of A. It doesn't see the ground field. Whereas this dimension, which depends a bit on AE, sees effects of the ground field. And from this fact that I said that one can express any X group as a Hochschild cohomology group, one deduces, as I said, that this, here still all full of Witt groups. So one can define PD A SAE module to be other way around, to be just the dimension of A. So this is simply the supremum over all N, such that there exists a bimodule with a non-vanishing Hochschild cohomology group. Yeah? And, And one deduces that that this dimension of A is always greater or equal the global dimension. So A is called regular if this global dimension is finite. And in the commutative case, this simply means smoothness of the variety under consideration. But nevertheless, I mean, if the algebra A might be a field, for example, then global dimension is zero, but this field might be huge, and we might consider it as an algebra over a very small field, and then this left-hand side might be infinite. And if you look here at this Poincaré duality, this Poincaré duality, of course, implies that all the Hochschild cohomology groups with arbitrary coefficients are zero above D. Yeah? So if an algebra A satisfies this Poincaré duality thing in Hochschild homology and cohomology, then this dimension of A must be this number D. And in particular, it must be finite. And in the commutative case, this implies smoothness. Yeah? So somehow, yeah, in fact, I wrote that up. The commutative case, to be more precise, what I claim is that if we take a coordinate ring of an affine variety, then it will satisfy this type of Poincaré duality if and only if the variety is smooth. And we can express this invertible bimodule omega giving you the Poincaré duality in very geometric terms. It's just the top degree Keller differentials or the dual, rather. Yeah? So multi-vector fields in top dimensions, something like volume forms. Yeah? So yes, I mean, you have this classical Poincaré stuff inside, but rather on the level of differential forms than on cohomology, and therefore, in the commutative case, this rather reduces to smoothness than to Gorenstein property, which is a bit weaker. Yeah? Okay. And in particular, I mean, if we now come back to our quantum groups, if we take the coordinate ring of an affine algebraic group, then the cotangent and tangent bundle is trivial, and we see that for these, we can identify this dualizing bimodule omega just with A itself. Okay, so that's the commutative case, and now, so the main result which we obtained is that if you now take these quantum groups, then they satisfy this theorem. You know? To be precise, what Tom and I did is we showed that for G equal SLN, yes, all these assumptions of Vandenberg's theorem are satisfied, and even more, the dimension D in which all this happens is the classical dimension of the group, and this invertible bimodule giving you the Poincaré duality is always the algebra itself twisted on this one hand side by this modular automorphism. Yeah? And in particular, if you plug this in into this Poincaré duality, you see that Hochschild homology of A with coefficients in that A sigma in degree dim of G is identifiable with Hochschild cohomology of A with coefficients in A in degree zero. And that's the center of the algebra, which is known to be C. Yeah? So this is somehow the mechanism which explained our computations, which we did quite clumsily for SL2. And I think it's, I mean, geometrically very nice, because in general, I mean, Hochschild homology and cohomology groups are, by definition, modules over the center of an algebra. Yeah? And you see that indeed this somehow says, okay, there is really a unique volume form of that quantum group in this deformed theory, if you want to. Yeah? And it's clear that you only want, in fact, that in the non-commutative case, your top Hochschild homology group is one dimension as module over the vector space. I mean, classically, of course, one wants that if you identify Hochschild homology with differential forms, then as vector spaces, the top group is infinite dimensional. Yeah? But if you think in terms of modules over the center, yeah, then this precisely says that in this twisted setting, one has the same statement as classically. The top degree Hochschild homology becomes identified with the center of the algebra. Okay, and in the meantime, this was taken up by much bigger guys than we are, and Ken Brown and James Zhang in fact prove that this holds essentially for all Noetherian Hopf algebras. Yeah? So to be precise, you need a property called Artin-Schelder-Gorenstein-ness, which essentially says something about the X groups of the trivial module, and then you see, okay, if you have this property, then you will also have this Poincaré duality in Hochschild homology and cohomology. And they really ensure that essentially all known examples of Noetherian Hopf algebras fit into that. And in particular, all the CQGs, all the CQGs, all the UQGs, and so on and so forth. Yeah? So this Poincaré duality is not a rare effect somehow. You know? It's really, if you have nice non-commutative algebras, then they tend to satisfy this. Okay, so finally I should say what this modular automorphism is. I mean, I said in the beginning that this CQG, sorry?
It's a generalization. What was the dualizing module?
Sorry? In there? Yeah, that's a bit the problem. I mean, so the point is, I mentioned this result by Feng and Cigan. I mentioned this result by Feng and Cigan. Where was it? Here, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I mean, this is for Tor. There's a dual version for X. Yeah. So the dual version for X says that. So the dual version for X says that. What does the dual version says? It says that Xn, that Hochschild cohomology of A with coefficients in some n is an X in the A modules in the same degree of the ground field, comma some left module L of M. And here, I mean, again, L of M is the same as M as vector space. I mean, of course, n, sorry. And the module here is essentially something like that, but even easier, it's the left adjoint action. So you just, I mean, you do it the other way around. You know, you act with one, A1 from one side, and with that from the other. And this Gorenstein property just says that if you plug in here A, then this is zero everywhere except in one degree, where it's one-dimensional as vector space. And then, so if it's one-dimensional as vector space, then this defines a character of the algebra, and this comes from an automorphism which they call the Nakayama automorphism, because for finite dimensional Hopf algebras this seems to be a quite developed theory. But
it seems that the cyclic homology is defined exactly when you have this kind of things, because you have the character, which is, so it's related to.
Yes, it's yes. I mean, at the end probably I'll come to that. I mean, this Hopf cyclic theory, as Piotr worked out, this is somehow if you go, this is the simplest case. If you want to, you take Laurent polynomials acting on your algebra by that automorphism, and Laurent polynomials are commutative, co-commutative, so you take as modular pair involution just the trivial one, and then your underlying Hochschild theory is precisely that. Yeah. As long as the automorphism acts diagonalizable. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Okay. So this was the general thing. So in general, they introduced this Nakayama automorphism and showed that this is the one, but they did not compute it explicitly for arbitrary CQG. Yeah. But as I said, in our paper, I mean, we worked for SLN, did everything quite basic and by bare hands, and then one really sees that this automorphism is this modular automorphism. So what is this modular automorphism finally? I said in the very beginning that these CQGs are as co-algebra the same as the classical coordinate ring. And I already mentioned this. This is essentially saying that the CQGs satisfy a Peter-Waldheit theorem. But Peter-Waldheit theorem is, of course, also the same as saying that there is the Haar measure in the classical case. Yeah? So, and this carries over to the quantum case. Aha, but I, of course, should go back to the slide. Sorry. This carries over to the quantum case. So any Hopf algebra is a left and a right co-module over itself by its co-product delta, and then one can ask, are there linear functionals on the Hopf algebra which are something like left and right invariant under this co-action? And this happens if and only if the Hopf algebra is co-semi-simple as a co-algebra, the direct sum of its simple subcoalgebras. So this is precisely Peter Weyl. And as I said, if you have a classical coordinate ring, this precisely means, okay, take this polynomial and on the complex group, restrict it to the compact real form and integrate with respect to Harmeser. No? So this Harmeser somehow can be generalized to the quantum case, but it's no longer a trace. No? And this modular automorphism comes in exactly here. No? This modular automorphism tells in how far this Harmeser on the quantum group fails to be a trace. No? So that's this modular automorphism. And I mean, okay, one at that school in Oberwolfach some years ago, I mean, the first thing Alain was speaking about was, of course, the old things with modular group and non-commutative spaces develop in time and so on. And I think this Vandenberg theorem gives quite an interesting, purely algebraic, different approach to that story. You know? Because it's really, you start with an arbitrary non-commutative algebra and you look at its Hochschild homology. And in good cases, it will distinguish you an automorphism, which is unique up to inner automorphism, which really just comes from the algebra. Yeah? There's no more choice.
For a Neumann algebra and see if you can recover.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, the point is if you do then the quantum groups as C star algebras, yeah, then the answer is yes. I mean, precisely this half functional becomes the state of the regular representation which defines you the things in Hilbert space and so on. Yeah, and so it's really in a sense the same thing.
No, but Neumann algebra is much more general.
Yes, I mean clearly, I'm not making
the non-unimodular group, which is this case.
Yeah.
Much more general.
Yes, of course. I mean, but in a sense, it's really, I mean, it's not complete coincidence only linguistically. Okay, so how many time do I have?
10 more minutes.
10 more minutes. Yeah, that's very good. So this was the story, and then Nikola Ciccoli came to Warsaw and gave nice lectures about Poisson geometry, and we said, okay, let's look whether there's some Poisson background of all that story. Because in fact, I mean, as I said, the old paper by Feng and Zigan did much more just to say, ah, look, these are the Hochschild homology groups. They gave quite a nice picture in terms of Poisson geometry, and okay, I think if 10 minutes I at least can sketch that. Okay, so Poisson algebra, I think all of you know, you take a commutative algebra, and you want that to be a Lie algebra with respect to some bracket which is a bidifferential operator. And what Greenfeld suggested in the beginning of the 80s was to study the connection between this and algebraic groups. So he asked, if you take an algebraic group or a Lie group, are there such Poisson structures which are compatible with a group structure in the sense that you take the product Poisson bracket on A tensor A and ask, is the coproduct, which corresponds to the group structure, is this a map of Poisson manifolds, of Poisson varieties? And then he classified these things. And indeed, our SL2C example, I mean, that's what I meant with it's essentially the only possible choice. You know, there you do not have many of these. And then there was the question about quantization. And I think that the final answer to that question was given by Ettinghoff and Kashtan, who showed that given such a Poisson algebraic group, then you always can quantize this in a nice way in the following sense. You can take the abelian group, first of all, of all formal power series in a parameter h bar with coefficients in that commutative algebra A, and you turn this into a module over the formal power series in an intermediate h bar over C, and you introduce a Hopf algebra structure on that. Now, a Hopf algebra over that ring K, formal power series in h bar, and the algebra structure is simply in zeroth order approximation, the classical one, first order approximation, the Poisson bracket, and all the higher terms are bidifferential operators. So that's what they call a local quantization. Yeah? So that all this is happy when going to localizations and so on. And in addition, in this Ettinghoff-Kashtan paper, it was pointed out that you can choose this product in a way such that the co-product is in fact the old one. Yeah? So that's some of this mechanism I mentioned at the beginning. And in a sense, that one can say, okay, that's how our CQGs arise. I mean, of course, one must be a bit careful when trying to make this rigorous, because CQG was an algebra over C, this is over formal power series, And this parameter Q, which we had was a number, and corresponds in this picture somehow to the formal power series to e to the h bar, but there are ways to make rigorous statements in that direction. So essentially the structure is exactly this. And now whenever you are given a Poisson variety, then there's something, some cohomology theory attached to that. And I think the nicest formulation of that was clarified out by Hübschmann, who said, okay, if you have such a Poisson variety which is smooth, then the Kähler differentials become finally projective modulo over that. And then you can introduce the structure of a Lie algebraoid on that. So you give the Kähler differentials a Lie algebra structure coming from the Poisson bracket, and then the Kähler differentials act via this formula on the algebra, and also the algebra acts on the Kähler difference by multiplication, and all this is nicely compatible and so on. So that's all put in this notion of Lie algebraoid, or Lie-Reinhardt algebra, as it is also called. And given such a Lie-Reinhardt algebra, you can construct something like a universal enveloping algebra of that. So this is a universal, this is an associative algebra U containing A as a subalgebra and this Lie algebra as a Lie algebra, and it's generated by these two parts. And then you define Poisson homology and cohomology, or at least you can do if you want, as tau and X over this universal enveloping algebra. Yeah? And if you take as coefficients A itself, then you recover the theory which was done by Brilinski and Lichnorowicz and Kosul by explicit chain complexes. And in that paper by Hübschmann, he pointed out that indeed on this level of Poisson homology and cohomology, you always have this Poincaré duality as arising from this Isherbeck spectral sequence which I showed you in the proof of this Vandenberg theorem. Yeah? So on the level of Hochschild homology and cohomology, you have such Poincaré duality effects. And that was the point where we said, okay, I mean, this must be just the semi-classical picture of what we see in the quantum case, because this old paper by Feng and Sigan indeed showed that when you start with such a quantization, you get a spectral sequence somehow approaching Hochschild homology of the quantization and starting with Poisson cohomology, and the main part of the paper was then to show that everything converges for these quantum groups nicely. And we checked that indeed, I mean, it's almost obvious that you can plug in coefficients in this spectral sequence. And then indeed, if you have such a dualizing bimodule as in Vandenberg, and you take its semi-classical limit, you recover the dualizing bimodule or the dualizing module of that Poisson theory, which is called the modular class of that Poisson variety. Yeah? So as I said, that's not worked out in detail yet, but I think it looks quite happy that we see, okay, all this Poincaré duality really comes as well from Poisson geometry and has nice pictures in terms of the underlying Poisson variety and its symplectic foliation and so on. And I think I should stop, right?
I suppose the free resolution that you mentioned for SL2
corresponds
to the 3D calculus, which has the classical dimensions for the algebra.
Where is it? Yeah. Here.
Yeah, and that presumably corresponds to the Voronovich 3D calculus on SL2. You know,
these calculi are free as modules. So you can say yes, it is the calculus.
The question is,
but the differential goes the other way around.
Yes, yeah? Of course. So the question is, does this mean that in general, or it's in some generality, you also have a calculus with the classical dimensions? Because this is actually...
That's a good question, of course. I mean, the question is, okay, how does this go for general groups? I mean, that's what we tried. If you do this by bare hands for SL3 already, things become huge. You don't want to do that.
I mean, put it another way. Your result says there is a kind of volume form.
Yes.
So is there a differential geometry of which this is the volume form, the top form?
The hope is yes, but I mean, if I'm honest, I cannot make a precise statement claiming for general groups G there is this and that. You know? But yes, I mean, one should say this Poincaré duality, you then can get it by some sort of cap product with this volume form and so on. So one thinks, yes, it will be. I mean, you can take... I mean, we know, yes, there is a unique volume form, you know, from the abstract theorem. And we can take this as a volume form, yeah, and realize this Poincaré duality by products with that, but we do not have an explicit formula. Yeah? But in the case SL2, it looks very nice. You really take generators of the kernel of the co-unit, and you do something like wedge products with it, and so on. Yeah? So one definitely guesses yes, but there is no rigorous proof available yet.
Well, about uniqueness, one has to be a bit careful, because this right-hand isomorphism is only valid for Q generic.
Yes. No, I'm a Q transcendental person, or not a root of unity. I mean,
right, if not, we thank the speaker again.